outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey. The God Journey.
Two things I have for you, Kyle. Two things. Number one, Sarah says it's coral, not pink and not salmon. So just to be clear, Sarah gave that commentary right off. Second thing, we have a moving date.
You have a moving date.
We have
a formal moving date.
Finally, we're on the home stretch. May 30 is our target now move-in date. We've given notice on the apartment. So
okay,
we're going to be out of here and have to live somewhere, maybe in your basement again. Who knows? But we got to be somewhere for a while.
You have an open invitation.
Yeah, May 30 seems to be it. It's
okay.
It's amazing. Some of the high risk things we took on this home.
Okay.
In terms of design.
Okay.
Has turned out far more incredible than we thought. So
really,
we were over there yesterday. Yes. Finally, all that starting to take shape. So you can kind of go, oh, that's going to really work, but. Not my office. My office is still a wasteland. Yeah, my studio, I got nothing going there yet.
Are you going to soundproof it? Are you going to do like a formal studio?
Not soundproof. Just, I mean, like a artist studio, a working studio. But
okay.
Yeah, it's not going to be soundproofed and all that. But I got to be careful, though, because my contractor the other day, he mentioned this thing about incremental change.
Okay.
Which... he had heard our podcast about going to Hawaii to avoid the incremental changes day by day. And he goes, incremental change. And I'm going, it was hilarious. So now I know Paul's listening to the podcast occasionally.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'll be a little more careful. But still, my studio as of today is still a wasteland.
And okay.
We have that joke all the time because everything else in the house has moved forward by leaps and bounds. And my studio, nothing. Nothing. It's a dump in there. I gotta be honest about it. It's just a dump. It was a storage room. In fact, they were calling it a storage room. So.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm gonna call it a dump till I see something. But I think this week maybe we'll have some movement. I don't know. The kitchen definitely has movement, and the atrium has movement. But.
Well, especially if you've got a move-in date of May 30th, hopefully the wasteland is no longer a wasteland. You got a couple of weeks still, but...
Well, we can move in and not move into the studio. So, you know...
That's true.
Yeah, so it's not... But we're hoping good things happen. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. The best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
I had a fun one. I was in a conversation with a friend, and this statement came up. What is the difference between loving the idea and loving the reality of the idea?
That's similar to the last one you did.
It is kind of similar to that. Yeah. It was very much along the same veins. And yet, man, I think too often we get into this space where we've fallen in love with the idea of something. And yet that shuts off a lot of space for us to actually enjoy the reality of what that thing is. And I think we miss a lot of the unique characteristics that, you know, even in our own minds and our own constructs that are actually better if we take time to appreciate and be present and enjoy what the reality is versus our idea of it.
Yeah. And there's a whole human spectrum of whatever inside those options, right? Because our idea of something, it's easy to idealize an idea. It is.
Yes.
And then it's easy to live in the frustration that I can't have my ideal or my idea. But reality is what changes us. It is. When my ideas and hopes and aspirations come against the cold, hard reality of life, that's where the opportunity for change and for growth and for insight and for stuff happens. If everything we idealized just came about the way we ideated it, and then you can read enough where it actually looks like it does for most people.
Yeah.
One of those, Sarah and I watched the Michael J. Fox documentary that's on Apple right now, and diagnosed with Parkinson's at 23. Now, you look at his life from the outside before you know any of that, and everything looks so, he gets a job, a big, you know, the Back to the Future movies, the TV series. On the outside, everything looks great. Underneath that, you can now see all the pain and reality that's there. And it changes you. It changes the nature of life. And it's okay. Here's the thing. It's okay to dream. It's okay to have ideas. It's okay to have all that hope. What's not okay is to think that your hopes and ideas have to become reality.
Which is intriguing because so the context for this conversation, this idea was Joshua Harris and purity culture and the impact that a lot of those ideals and those standards that were molded in the midst of purity culture has had. And I've talked to so many individuals, especially coming out of like the millennial demographic, that were so deeply impacted by that. And they're still in their, even some of them in their successful marital relationships are really fighting this ideal of a relationship or the idea of this thing that was set forward versus enjoying the reality of it. Or I know a lot of individuals that are not married and are still, they're still pursuing the ideal. This thing that was broadcasted for them that they can't let go of. And now they're in their mid-30s, early 40s, and still have this ideal in their head and yet long for a relationship, but don't know why they can't connect the idea in their head versus the reality of humanity around them.
It's a good example, too, because here the person with the idea and the idealization has already repudiated it.
Yes. So yes, absolutely.
Okay, it wasn't even their idea. Someone gave them the idea. They're still on the idea and maybe have not known or heard that the guy who had the idea is no longer using the idea, no longer promotes the idea. In fact, he openly discredits himself.
Yeah.
That makes it tougher.
In the process of sorting out the authentic life of Christ versus the brand of Christianity, that's where it gets really hard. That's where I feel like it gets pretty tricky. Because all of a sudden you're navigating things where there's this idea, but how do we know that our idea actually is in alignment with who he is? And I feel like, I mean, you look through scripture, how many ideas of what the savior was going to be and the role that he was going to play? I mean, how many ideas did the original Hebrew people have on what that was going to look like? And yet Jesus is standing there saying, you know the Torah word for word. Like, you know the fulfillment of the scriptures standing literally in front of you, and yet you can't recognize it.
Yeah.
The power of idea versus the freedom to sit and enjoy and be curious about reality is incredible.
And the interplay between them both shape us, right? An idea desire what may pursue a certain course of action.
Mm-hmm.
Then reality presses in. So, okay, this ideal I'm not going to get to. It's that reality is shaping that. Even a year ago, that thing about this will change your life, the thing that God, this will change the trajectory of your life. And it has done that.
Yeah.
At the time when I'm hearing that, I'm like going, oh, I liked what I was doing. I liked the trajectory I was on.
Yeah.
I like this trajectory so much better. But and somehow we've got to let both of those work together. So the ideal hits a wall. The wall shapes the ideal, but most people don't do that. They'll keep running the ideal against the wall, the proverbial beat your head against a rock, and realize this is not progressing. So there's the interplay in God. It's okay to have visions and dreams and ideas and then let the reality of how God shapes the course of your life, because nothing is going to turn out the way you think it will when you're 24, 25, or 32, or even 68. It's not necessarily going to turn out that way.
You know, this has kept coming up in the idea of like being pulled into the God-shaped life, right? Allowing him to allure us into the God-shaped life.
I think the word is letting him draw us.
I like the idea of him alluring us into the
God-shaped
life.
Sounds like fish bait, but okay.
Oh, romance. Like, that's the same word he uses. Hebrews, Hosea 2. So that's, I'm going back to my favorite passage and him alluring me into a God-shaped
life.
Okay,
I'll let you go with that. But
I think about that. And I think about even the ideas that I have of him and some of them that I was so, they were so deeply ingrained. And it was like, why am I so bought into this? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it that has me so committed to this idea that I don't have the freedom to course correct? I don't have the freedom to allow the reality to shape that versus my idea, it being so vital that my idea become a reality that I'm not willing to or don't have the ability to view the beauty that's trying to be introduced into my life.
Yeah, because the pursuit of an idea that's not going to happen is a very frustrating life.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
What about you? What was the best thing that you heard this week?
Oh, this is a quote on restorative justice by Ted Lewis. It's a little bit long, but it says, if your child throws a ball and breaks your neighbor's window, what do you do? Invariably, adults will say, I would take the child with me to the neighbor to apologize, to listen to what the neighbor has to say, and to offer to make amends. This, of course, is what the neighbor would want, too. If, on the other hand, the neighbor found out that the child was merely punished and no communication efforts were made, he or she would rightly feel that justice was not done, precisely because the victim was ignored. So here's the quote. Restorative justice focuses on the harm done more than the law broken. Attention to the harm draws greater attention to the victims and thus to repairing them.
Ooh.
I think when we were teaching our kids growing up, you know, say you're sorry and the other one had to say, yeah, I forgive you. It was all transactional and fairly empty. It wasn't always restorative. It wasn't always helping the person who created harm understand the harm they created. And then in that harm, what can we do to repair? I think most of my life among evangelical Christians through most of my journey, not even very quick to say, I'm sorry. Everybody's always got to defend. I've been right about everything and you're the one that's wrong. I was like, okay, no human relationship works that way. There's always, there's room for both of us to have made some mistakes, to miscommunicate, to find the common ground that says, I'm sorry how I hurt you. You can respond in kind if you want. And that, I think those are, I've just was involved with somebody recently told about that, two parties that were at odds with each other. And it's definitely on both sides. And one goes and apologizes to the other, hoping to open a door for the apology to come back. And it doesn't. Oh, well, thank you very much. Don't do it anymore. Now, nothing got repaired there either, right?
Yeah,
because, but I love that. If you focus on the victim rather than a rule was broken, now you're going to be able to do something that may be restorative. And I don't mean just that. I mean, this is obviously restorative justice talking about crime and neighborhoods or whatever. And I think it has great implication there.
Yeah.
It also has great application just in our interpersonal relationships. If I've wronged someone, the offer to repair is awesome. Is there anything I can do to make this up to you? And then sometimes you'll people say, yeah, cut your head off with a sharp stick and throw yourself off a cliff. Well, yeah, that's not going to work. But What can you do to repair? And it's a great way to think about just beyond covering my tail, saying I'm sorry for something, and then not worrying about what damage it caused. And actually, that's been a lot in Sarah and my story over the last year, because certainly her trauma and some of the counsel she got did incredible damage.
Yeah.
But she'd been really good. We've both been really good at finding a way to repair the damage. How do you restore trust after you move out on somebody? You know, how does it restore trust in my heart for her decision she's making and for what she's doing and where she's going?
Hmm.
When something's broken and God heals it, there's just nothing more beautiful in the creation. I know brokenness and problems are hassles and they're hurtful and all that stuff. But man, when God gets in there and stuff heals, even relationships we've had that have gone awry and then God heals them later, and nothing more beautiful.
Yeah, just a couple of weeks ago, I got an open door to have a conversation with my dad about some of the things that he and I had navigated in our relationship and the impact that it had on me. And I had the opportunity to just verbalize to him that the restoration of he and I's friendship and our relationship was one of the greatest miracles I've been able to experience in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Because it is that. I mean, yes, there was deep wounding there. Are there still things that I'm healing from and on his side as well? Absolutely. But there wasn't the anger, the bitterness. There was forgiveness and there was freedom there. And now it's more of just navigating the byproducts of some of the wounds and some of the hurt that did occur. There's still healing that has to take place there. But in regards to this open, festering wound that is the relationship, it's been flushed out, cleaned, sanitized, stitched back up, and actually allowed to heal in some really cool ways. When you see, especially when you see a relationship, they're like, I can't imagine a way back into that. And yet seeing God do that, and it took time. I mean, we're talking over a decade of mutual work on both sides to start really stepping towards one another again. So it's not a quick fix. It's not an easy fix, but man, that is good work. And a lot of the time, I didn't even know what God was up to. I didn't know that he was simultaneously creating an opportunity for me to move back towards the relationship with my dad as I was doing some of my own personal work. And as I was learning some of like the trusting things with my relationship with my heavenly father and navigating that, that translated out and it had more ripple effects than just my personal relationship with God. It rippled out to other ways and other interpersonal relationships.
I like that. Going to somebody and communicating, you're sorry, hearing from them, like letting them, I think that's big in an apology thing, letting someone process their pain with you that you might have caused. So, and you may not feel all of that's justified, but hearing how they understood it, perceived it, were hurt by it, gives you the ability then to repair. And hopefully if they're generous on the other side of that by going, you know, I realize I probably made some mistakes here too, then all the better, because that will help. Like I said, I don't think there's any human interaction in which somebody comes out all good and somebody comes out all bad. Even if it's no intention anywhere, it's just the miscommunication of human frailty is a big deal. And finding our way to navigate that, I think, is incredible. And like you said, the fruit of it, the healing that comes inside relationships and the damage that was repaired, it's almost like a broken arm that they set in men, and then it's stronger after the repair than it was before the repair. And I think that's true of the relationships I've been part of that have healed back. Go. And then you notice some that don't heal back at all. That even you've gone through the performative, I'm sorry, I forgive you, whatever. But it really wasn't about repairing the relationship. It was about just covering guilt so people could come. I think of the one of the elders who helped Sarah and I depart the congregation we were part of called me one morning. They had some, this was about a year after we had been dismissed and no severance package, no nothing. And he calls me up one morning and he says, can I come over and see you today? It was Sunday morning. And he wanted to come over in the afternoon. I said, yeah, come on over. So he comes over and he sits down, and they had some kind of move of God that morning that lent toward unresolved offenses. So he wanted to come over to find out, you know, he just wanted to come over to apologize to me for something. And I had asked him a very specific question years before when things were going awry and I was sensitive to stuff going on. I would ask him, did this happen? Because I was told it had.
Yeah.
And he denied it to my face, but I knew he was lying to me because I knew it had happened.
Yeah.
But he denied it, swore, never, whatever. So now 2-3 years later, he's coming back to me and he said, you know, that thing you said happened, it really did. I've always felt bad about lying to you. So will you forgive me? I'm going, yeah, of course. Absolutely. You're forgiven. Is that all? And he goes, what do you mean? Is that all? I said, dude, look what happened here. You lied to a congregation of people about a resignation I didn't offer. You did this, you did that. And I said, now you come over here and you say, I want to apologize for this one lie I told you before all that. And he goes, and I said, no, because what I feel like is you broke my window, came into my house, raped my wife. And then you come back a couple years later and you say, I want to apologize for breaking your window. Now, this is the least important thing you did. And he goes, I didn't come over for any of that other stuff. And then he rushes out the door. So I knew immediately this was only about clearing a conscience thing for him. It had nothing to do with me and what had happened to me. And that's a great parable for how Christianity forgiveness things kinds of work. I'm just trying to fix my conscience. And that's probably one of the things we're going to talk about today was generous compassion.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that I think, because in evangelical Christianity, there's very little margin with God or life or anything. So everybody's trying to survive. I'm not thinking broadly enough to, boy, did I hurt you and what can I do to help? I'm only thinking about, I feel bad for something I did. And then we had a sermon, this, I'm going to try and clear it and get out. And I think he was very surprised. I was going, dude, there's something so much bigger here. Do you want to talk about that? No. That's not why I came. God told me to come over here and do this. And yeah, evangelicalism is weird that way, because there is no margin to stop and consider how what I'm doing is impacting people around me. I've only got to be focused on me, defend myself, make myself look good, because that's the whole thing, right? If we're not doing it right, if there's right and wrong and I'm on a wrong side, that's bad. And I noticed growing up and all that, I very rarely apologize to people. And I notice now when I apologize to people, who are inside that, they almost never accept the apology. Hmm. It's never good enough. They, no, my hurt is this and that. And I'm just going, oh, hold on a minute. You know, I said I was sorry. I think we miscommunicated there. No, no, you intended something evil. I honestly didn't. I can't apologize. Listen to a podcast recently about a man that got put in prison for something he didn't do because the cops needed somebody to hang this crime on, and they chose him. And even the cops knew it wasn't true. And he finally got out. But he's being led as he's come up for parole. You need to own the crime. We'll parole you. And he's going, I didn't do the crime. And then it's, oh, no remorse. So even when it's his best interest to fake remorse, he doesn't do it. And he says, how do you apologize to someone for something you didn't do? Hmm. That's profound to me. How do you apologize to somebody for something you didn't do? You can't. So
yeah,
problem for sure. Well, let's talk about generous compassion a little bit, because I think this kind of maybe leads up to it, because it's the third of the five attributes of what God produces. And there's probably more. We're not saying these are all inclusive. Things I've noticed in my life, things I've drawn from scripture, things that we've talked about from seeing in the lives of other people. We've covered already sincere love, and last week, a resilient trust. This one, a generous compassion. What a beautiful statement. I'm the one, I've shared this a million times. I scored in the bottom 2% of the nation in my high school aptitude test on sociological concerns. Remember my counselor saying, Wayne, you don't even like people. That was after she asked me what I was going to go train for, and which was be a pastor. She said, you don't even like people. I know. What's the point of that? I just want to teach sermons in the pulpit on Sunday morning. So for my life to move from that, I've got a couple that we know, we're with them recently. Their mid-20s, year old daughter just died. And beautiful young woman got trapped in some drug stuff and some wrong crowd. Number of times came out of it. Looked like things were going to really go well, you know, repented, God, hell, and then plunged back in there. And then that all ended in death here recently. And I say yesterday morning, just reading something that this man had written and about his daughter and the love of his wife, his Mother's Day. So he's writing the love of his wife for a daughter whose life went so sad. And you know what? I'm all that completely undone just reading it. And I know them, so that's part of it. But
yeah,
I think of the Wayne of 25, 30 years ago. You know, I could hear something bad happens and, you know, be sorry and say the right things, but not feel it down in your gut. Yeah. And I love what God has shaped in my heart, where there's a compassion for things that there wouldn't have been in the same way. I mean, I think I still would have been very aware this is a horrible tragedy.
Yeah.
But I think even in where I grew up in, it would have been, well, if she hadn't done all that stuff, if she'd have gotten her life together, she would have. So you kind of blame the person for the tragedy, then it's not as bad a tragedy, right?
Yeah. And it's a justifiable tragedy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's one you earned, so to speak. And it's just not helpful. And I'll say that growing up with an evangelical God, that God was never very generous for all the reasons we've just talked about. You know, I have my ideal. God's supposed to give me my ideal. God doesn't give me my ideal. Reality frustrates me. It makes me angry at God that God didn't fix my reality to conform to my idea or ideal. And yeah, I didn't grow up with a generous God. So I wasn't a generous person. It was survival. Be as righteous as you can be. Climb the evangelical ladder as far as you can climb it. The focus was always here on me and what I need to do. And yeah, yes, you're supposed to love one another. So you do a modicum of things to show that you're compassionate to other people, but it was a show. It felt more like a show. And it's not either or, it's not all light or dark here, but the trajectory has definitely been into a more generous space with God. I found God not to be very generous when I'm trying to get him to fulfill my agenda. So I'm thinking of God's very miserly. I read stuff about God's loving kindness and all those good things. And I go, hey, I don't know. Now I read those things inside God's purpose unfolding in a life. And this God is incredibly generous.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I always have more money than I know what to do with, or always I have next, so much of our journey. Sarah and I never had the next month figured out. It was just we learned to live on the generosity of God, living in his purpose. And we found that God was incredibly generous. And that's, I think, where when you discover that and you live with more margin in your life because you're not living so miserly, then compassion is very easy to take root in your heart. You can put yourself in the shoes of other people. I could put myself in the shoes of this father this weekend. If I just lost my daughter, how would that affect me? Or one of my granddaughters. This had been their story. And motherhood's tough enough when you just have normal children growing up in the capriciousness of life. When you have a daughter go really sideways and there's these moments of prayer and intervention and it looks like repentance and gets into a program and comes out of it and looks like, well, I've conquered this thing. And then to watch her slide back into it and it finally take her life. And yeah, compassion, generous compassion. And it is probably moving from a self-focused life, which is what sin's always about, a self-focused life.
Yeah.
And I think even to some extent, the evangelicalism that I grew up in that was kind of down on social action, down on social concerns, it was all about achieving and attaining in God. And it was very self-focused. How do I get to the top of the heap? How do I do my ministry? How do I? You don't make much room for an other's focused life. But I know in my, and I'm not perfect here by a long stretch, but I know in my 30-year trajectory on this living love path, things deeply hit my heart that didn't used to. And then this generous compassion. So compassion is something, and it doesn't mean just doing loving things for real. Compassion, come to suffering. It's wanting to be near in with people who are hurting. It's especially directed at the marginalized. It is.
Yes.
You don't short it for other people who aren't marginalized, but people who are on the outer edges of financial productivity. I look at what happened with Louis and Maria. We told them my friend Louis' story where I, you know, growing up as a farmer's child in a farm worker's environment, you're really down on illegal immigration and you see as an issue. Now you have a friend who you find out who thought was legal here and then find out he's not. And now that you already love them. So it's not an issue anymore. It's a person.
Correct.
I love that. And I love how making space for other people, particularly their limited resources and ways we've come alongside them, just because I don't know how my grandchild gets medical care and their child doesn't, and they can't afford it and they're hurting. How do I not help? It's inconceivable to go, you know what? If you just stayed in Mexico and, you know, where the cartels were putting everybody at risk and everything would, you know, you'd follow the rules and God will take care of it. It's just cheap language.
Yeah. I got into a really interesting conversation with an aspiring clinician. They're training, they're finishing up their PhD. And we just got on that. We got on that subject. And this individual came from a very conservative Christian background. And they kind of, we were talking about some other things and they paused the conversation and they're like, Kyle, how do you answer someone who is really dismissive or challenging about working with specific audiences? And I mean, and I've had conversations with people like this clinician in the topics of addiction, in the topics of LGBTQ identity, and I mean, there are lots of different subjects. And this individual asked, so what do you say to these people who are challenging, you know, they're after them and they're challenging these people and like, how could you love them? How could you care about them? You know, how could you believe that's okay, etc. My response has shifted to, I would love to have this conversation with you when you have a relationship with somebody in your life, in your circle of influence that is an intimate part of your world, that is navigating whatever challenge you're talking about. When you have somebody in your life that is an intimate friend or a family member or somebody that you deeply care about, and they're in your life and they're navigating that, I would love to have this conversation with you. But until they're just a they out in the ethereal distance, and there's nobody in your context. They're not a human being. They're just a they. They're just this. I'm not interested in having that conversation.
It's one of the weapons we use, isn't it? We create the other. We make somebody an other. So my group is this, and we do that. As one friend said to me, I was expressing some concern for some of the LGBTQ concerns, and a friend of mine said, how come you love transgendered children more than you love Christians? And I'm like, okay, really, I didn't know that I had to choose. And you just, there's no ability for them to grasp that, that it was an issue to them. Just like you said, it's an issue.
Yeah.
It's not an individual.
Correct.
And an individual doesn't change right and wrong. It doesn't change moral and immoral. It doesn't. Yeah. But loving somebody who's stuck in a place of darkness, if you want to consider it darkness, loving them is the first opportunity to help them. Judging them is not.
Yeah.
Judging them as the other, you get to dismiss because God has an away team and a home team, and you're on the home team and they're on the away team.
Yeah.
I grew up in that. That's very easy for me to be part of because it really keeps your heart from caring for people.
Yeah.
That you're conflicted about the caring.
Yeah.
That I care about them as a person. Doesn't mean I'm going to give them a pass on loving them means you get to do whatever you want, because that's not how I live my life. That's not how God lets me live my life.
Yeah.
But in our most broken state, I mean, we can all read The Shack and see Mac and, oh, his daughter died. So, yeah, he's hurting. I can understand God loving a hurting guy and who's judged God to be wrong. So there's the, if you want to get to sin, there it is.
Yeah.
To judging somebody who's got some kind of gender confusion or some kind of same-sex attraction and doesn't know what to do with it, they're lost and stuck. How do you not concern? How do you not desire to help, to be alongside and not to judge, but not to be light on God's wisdom either, as it fits into the conversation, but a generous compassion. So it's not just compassion, even, and I know this touches a third rail, even capitalism, and I'm not a communist, don't believe in socialism, but I don't necessarily believe in complete capitalism either. You cannot live in our world and say that capitalism rewards the right things.
Yeah.
It doesn't. The people that get to the top of the heap with capitalism are often the creepiest people on the planet.
Yeah.
And there are people who capitalism rewards a certain kind of mindset.
Yes.
Right? And there are people that are on the fringes of that. They can't pull it off. And is there compassion, whether it's medical needs, whether it's food, whatever, is there a compassion that runs under, and being a generous, compassionate person?
Yeah.
Not in the rules of government, not in policy. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the way I live my life alongside hurting people, people outside the margins, people like Luisa Maria. I give you names of other people whose situations you don't know about that I would love and walk with and stand by and serve in any way I could serve them as God gives me the grace to do so. And for that, I know in my life, it changed from being a survivalist. I'm barely getting by. The demands and dreams and things that I want, I have to get, that's consuming my whole life. My enjoyments, my needs, my survival. And then when you find that love, rest, and play inside God, and God begins to show himself with you, and you're doing less out of your insecurities and anxieties, you end up with more margin in your life. You do. You're not the Samaritan that walks past the guy that had been beaten and laying bleeding by the side of the road to get to your discipleship group. You actually you just find it impossible to walk by that. I remember Dave Coleman saying to me when that same thing we talked about earlier about the pastoral situation I was in when it blew up, and he was there, and I was asking him one day, I said, where, because they were part of the fellowship for a while, then he left it for a while, then they kind of came back right at the end, and I said, where'd you guys go? Mm. He said, I could see you were about to get killed. I said, what? Mm. He said, I could see that you were a man who didn't love power, but there were people around you who did, and they were going to kill you, and I couldn't bear to watch it. I said, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I said, well, why'd you come back then? He said, oh, that was the other thing. I couldn't bear to see you go through it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the guy I leaned on, he and his wife. for Sarah and I, one of the, there's about four or five couples that were really instrumental getting us through that time. And yeah. He said, I watched happen to you what happened to me when he was a pastor. And he said, part of me just couldn't bear to watch it. And then the other part of me said, I can't let Wayne go through that alone. I want to be there for him. And that's compassion, because compassion is not, oh, I should be there to do something. It's I can't not be there because of the concern I have.
I was just in a conversation with my dad about career stuff. And like for me, I deeply value mental health. It also, it takes a toll to have your heart open and available to people and actually be that, to offer that, that generous compassion, right? To be there and to walk through it and be available for people. And it's like, man, do I want to keep doing that? And yet, Father, what are you calling me into in regards to this? Like what? I don't want a life that is just seeking my own personal comfort. If I can offer, I've had an incredible amount of generous compassion that has been offered to me. And do I walk away from being a generously compassionate person in an environment with people who desperately need it just because of the potential toll it might take? I don't know. But, you know, it's wrestling with those questions. And I, man, like, part of what they taught us was to quote unquote, keep your emotional distance. And it's like, I don't know how to do that. Like, I mean, yes, there's obviously creating boundaries and, you know, et cetera, but it's like, I don't know how to not show up and genuinely care about the person that's sitting across from me and walk away unimpacted by them and their story and what they're going through. I don't know how to do that.
That's the crazy thing about that profession, right? Because love is what really heals. It's not just wisdom, but they're not allowed to love because, a lot of it's gone awry and people end up, you know, having lustful thoughts for their clients. And so now we just like teachers can't hug their class, their students anymore because people get weird. It's always the weird people that ruin what love really is and needs to be in the world.
If people knew and had good friendships in their life, a lot of the work that I do on a regular basis wouldn't exist anymore. But because there isn't healthy community and healthy friendships where you're able to walk alongside of another person, have generous compassion for another person because you love them, even expressing that you love them, just because that doesn't exist. I mean, just the plethora of stuff that is unearthed because of that. It's just like, I think when you show up and you allow your heart to be seen, you make your heart available to others, it does start to get messy. It does start to get challenging. It does push you outside of your comfort zone. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why we also enjoy the us versus them or the home team and the away team is because if we actually know them, if they actually have access to our heart, then it's not as easy. We can't dismiss them. We don't have the armor against them. Because if we dismiss them or push them off or put them in the category of the others, then all of a sudden we can armor up against them and it doesn't have the emotional impact that it would have before.
Yeah. And I would say to people who you don't have the margin in your life right now to have compassion. You're barely surviving yourself.
Yeah.
That's why I go back to love, rest, and play, God's revelation in you. Find your life in him. Keep leaning in. Yeah. Don't like, I should be giving, I know I should do this. And so you end up with a whole lot more obligation to go out and have compassion for people that you don't have compassion for. Totally. I think what we're saying, I mean, even Jesus talked about there were times when he was moved with the bowels of compassion, where this deep inner, I'm healing this person, not because, well, I'm supposed to heal and today and that person looks needy, I'll do something for them. You can actually trust that God will put on your heart a compassion for people he wants you engaged with, even if they're not comfortable people to be around, or even if you know it's going to invite you into some triggering moments for your own pain, as Dave was to come back and walk me through my betrayal because he'd been through it himself.
Yeah,
he's willing to go there because he loved me. The things we do because we love Lewis and Maria, not because, well, we're trying to practice compassion for undocumented immigrants living in America. I hope people are hearing us. These two things couldn't be further apart. This is not an issue-oriented, go find some compassion. This is the next person you meet. And if I have enough margin in my life that God can move me for the need of someone. And I, well, you said earlier about you've been the recipient of a lot of generous compassion. I know that's true for me. And there are times when I'm with somebody who's going through darkness and I'll go, this, I'm paying it forward. If you want to use that silly expression, I'm paying it forward for what Dave did for me, for what Clyde Kilby did for me in my writing thing when I was a young man. For there have been people in my life who generously gave of their time, their resources, their emotion for me. So part of it is paying it forward, but part of it is having enough margin to recognize the opportunities when they come. Because if you don't have it, you're going right past people. Who you're going right past the person laying beaten up by the side of the road. Just not because I don't care. I didn't see it. How often do we look away from homeless or whatever? If we don't see it, we don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
Instead of, if I let people into my heart, and I'm asking God, what is a compassionate way to respond to that need? And I'm letting compassion, I'm letting the depth of it. So I think seeing generosity in others helps us discover this. I think deep wounds and hurts in our own life and places where we felt completely abandoned and alone. If you've been there, you never want anybody else to be there. If you know somebody's there, you're going to go sit down with them and say, how do I help you? What do you need from me? Knowing lack, knowing loneliness, knowing not having something to fall back on. I remember when I took this, the congregation I got thrown out of when they first was going to work there. I remember, and they don't really offer a salary because it's just a plant. We don't know what kind of money is going to be here. And I had one man pull me aside and he had a bit of money and he just said, listen, I want you to understand something. As long as my family eats, your family will eat. And that took an awful lot of pressure off. You know, and he never did. We never needed that, but it was amazing to have it offered and then have him be one of the guys who forced my departure. So I haven't checked back with him on that meal thing yet, but I haven't needed it either. Generous compassion is infectious in the world. It really is. It opens so many great doors. When you're ready, when you've got enough margin in your life, when you've been the recipient of enough, when you have space, when you have margin, don't feel guilty about not meeting a need you can't meet. And I know so many of these. I think of one of my excuses when I was younger, when somebody asked for help or something, well, I can't do this for everybody in the church, so I can't do it for you. Or I can't do it for everybody in the world, so I can't do it for you. And then the old starfish story of the kid throwing the starfish back and guy's saying there's millions of them on the beach. Why? What do you think your difference you're making? It makes a difference to this one. And that's God's, all God's asked us to do. And I'd encourage people to take a look at 2 Corinthians 8 through 10. It's a great story of generosity as Paul's inviting the early Christians in Corinth to be generous to the people in Jerusalem who are undergoing a great drought and great need. And he's talking about God's generosity. I used to read those scriptures going, I don't know this God. I mean, I pretend I did, and I'd still teach about it, but I don't know this God. Now I do. I know that God. I know how generous he is in the face of our pain and need, and I'm willing to be there with him and with you when you have that need in your life.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.